Hey everyone, it's Abadesi, your host of today's Product Hunt Radio, where I'm joined by the founders, investors, and makers that are shaping the future of tech. On this episode, I chat with Lambda School CEO and co-founder, Austin Allred. In this episode, we talk about his leadership style and the Lambda School mission, why he wants to transform education, his experiences living in East Ukraine and China, product market fit, and deciding to raise venture capital. We also discuss his favorite products, Slack, Notion, Pocket, Superhuman. But before we jump in, let's give a shout out to our sponsors.
If you're a writer, graphics designer, painter, musician, or some other breed of creative, your job is to turn ideas into products for your customers. Unfortunately, menial tasks like invoicing and expenses can steal time away from your creative process. FreshBooks invoicing and accounting software for creative professionals is the solution. It basically has no learning curve and on average saves users up to 192 hours a year. Set up your accounts and start invoicing in just minutes, track expenses and take photos of receipts with the mobile app, track time to record every billable hour, and automation is built in to save even more time. Right now, get a free 30-day trial of FreshBooks, no credit card required. Go to freshbooks.com/producthunt and enter Product Hunt Radio in the How Did You Hear About Us section. As some of you may know, in addition to my day job at Product Hunt, I also invest in early-stage startups thanks to AngelList Venture Fund Services. In 2017, I prepared a deck, raised some money from friends and people I've worked with over the years to bootstrap my first fund. I raised money and capital from LPs, and AngelList handled everything else, providing a dedicated account manager, a real-time dashboard to manage my portfolio and valuations, tools to keep my LPs up to date, and all the tax and accounting overhead. They make it super easy for me to move quickly. While still relatively new, AngelList has already hosted over 130 venture funds, which can range as small as $500,000 to tens of millions of dollars under management. And as a fund manager, your job is to simply find great entrepreneurs and choose who to invest in. Everything else is handled. If you're interested in starting a fund, learn more at angel.co/venturefunds or drop me a line at ryan@producthunt.com and I'd be happy to help.
So Austin, thank you so much for joining us today on Product Hunt Radio. You're one of my favorite people on Twitter and generally one of my favorite founders. There's been a lot of talk about you and Lambda School recently. But for those who aren't familiar with your work, tell us what you do and what you're working on.
Yeah, so at Lambda School, we train people to be software engineers, data scientists, and UX designers in live online classes. And it's completely free until you get a job that pays more than $50,000 a year. At which point you pay a percentage of your income for a couple of years.
Amazing. One of the things that I love about Lambda School is reading all of the stories of people who've been transformed by attending the course and have gone on to like really change the way they live, the way their families live, and you know, by really entering a new profession and raising their income significant levels, which I think is pretty cool. Why did you feel you had to tackle this issue? This isn't your first startup for people who are familiar. So why Lambda School?
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, before I was at Lambda School, I was at a company called LendUp in San Francisco, does, you know, kind of short-term lending. Really, it was just seeing that not much can influence somebody's life and their outlook so much as their income. And in, you know, we're just really, really bad at helping people get to the right place in where their income is. There's not a really efficient mechanism of moving people from, you know, if a factory closes down, those people are just kind of screwed. And that's crazy to me. It's crazy that there's not a way to rapidly shift people to where they should be in the economy.
Yeah, that's incredible. So could you maybe rewind back a bit into time? There's Austin Allred, I don't know, early 20s, deciding what he's going to do with his life. What were the kind of experiences and jobs that sort of like led you to where you are now?
Yeah, I've got a pretty crazy background. I grew up in a Mormon family in Utah. So I served an LDS mission in Eastern Ukraine for 2 years when I was 19. So I speak Russian fluently. Had just a great, incredible, difficult experience there. Came back, enrolled in college, but it was pretty boring. So I moved to China for a while, kind of vagabonded around homeless in China. Ended up coming back, decided to drop out of college and start a company. lived homeless in Silicon Valley while I was trying to get that off the ground. We eventually raised a little VC. That eventually failed. Then I went to work at LendUp, and then from there started Lambda School. So that's my entire history.
That's so interesting. I'm curious. I was born in America, and then I spent a lot of my time growing up not in America, in East Africa, in the UK. Do you think you would care about these issues as much if you hadn't had those experiences abroad?
Maybe. It's really hard to say, you know, in retrospect, what your cognitive load would look like if you hadn't had experiences, because it's just kind of, once that's etched in your mind, it's always etched and you can't unetch it to run a simulation. But I definitely think that if nothing else, the disparity became clearer that, you know, I live this, you know, obviously I still feel like I have my struggles and I'm still trying to make it. But relative to 99% of the world, I live a very charmed, very privileged life. And there's no reason that those people can't be, well, there are a lot of reasons, but we can eliminate the reasons that people can't have all the same stuff that I have or the same opportunity that I have. So when I was running that company, you know, we raised money when I was out here living in Silicon Valley, but I ran it remotely from kind of buying my wife's farm in the middle of nowhere in Utah. And so moving from there to San Francisco, there's a clear contrast in opportunity just based on, you know, what your familial income has been historically, where you live, a whole bunch of stuff. And yeah, I mean, we often talk about how opportunity is not evenly distributed, but talent is. And that's kind of a really big problem to solve. So we want to set about solving that.
That's one of the concepts that I lean into a lot, that idea of like the distribution of talent versus the distribution of opportunity. I was sort of educated in a culture that very much believed in things like meritocracy. So, you know, if you all work hard, then you're all going to get to the top or do well. And it was only really as I kind of got to my mid to late 20s that I started to educate myself on like structural oppression and like the dark side of capitalism and stuff like that. It was really enlightening for me to become more acquainted with these ideas and then just start to understand like how I could empathize better with people who have less privilege than me. So I really like that you brought that up, and I think that's really interesting. So as I mentioned earlier, I watched one of your TED Talks. You're one of your TEDx Talks. And I was really curious about the turning points or defining moments in entrepreneurs' lives, the way they respond to something quite unexpected that then kind of drives them forward to solve a problem or address something in the world that they would like to see differently. So I thought it might be interesting to kind of reflect on your life, and you could maybe share some of those defining moments for you. I mean, it sounds like you've got a lot you could draw on, but maybe the ones leading up to Lambda School.
Yeah. Let's see. I mean, certainly living in Eastern Ukraine for 2 years, for a variety of reasons. The first was you realize, I think that was the first time I realized that you can kind of do whatever you want and there's nobody to tell you yes or no. And it, when they are there, it doesn't really matter. And specifically, you know, I moved to Ukraine right after the financial crisis hit. The first town I lived in, a little town called Gorlovka, it's a kind of a mining town. And right after the crisis, all of the international investment into the mines kind of dried up. So it was massive unemployment. We're talking north of 50% unemployment. And seeing how stuck people felt and how, I don't know, it felt like there wasn't a path out. But then you meet a few people that, you know, you can jump on a train, you can go to Kyiv, there are actually a lot of things that you can do. I know. So I started to realize how, like, what people suppose is going to happen is affecting them. And I thought that was pretty important. And that's also honestly where I learned to just work hard. Part of the life of being a Mormon missionary is, you know, you're living on a very strict schedule. So we go to bed at 10:30, you wake up at 6:30, you have 30 minutes to exercise and shower, 30 minutes to eat. You study for 3 hours a day. You're out the door by 11 a.m. and you don't come home really until 9 p.m. And you're either knocking doors or you're talking to people in the street. and, you know, did that for 2 straight years. So you realize how much you can fit in a day and what real hard work actually looks like. And I don't think I had understood that until then.
That's awesome. I love that idea of focusing on hard work, because I remember once going to a founder's talk some years ago, and someone had stood up on stage and said, one of the most underrated like talents is the ability to work hard. And I think that's so true. Like, people kind of underestimate the power of just like diligence and relentless pursuit of something. And what I like about that focus on working hard is that it's like pretty accessible to everyone. Like, if you really have passion for something, then you can throw yourself into it. I didn't realize the life of a missionary was so intense, but it kind of almost sounds a bit like, you know, youth service or people that have like, you know, been in like military style environments. Was that a choice? Like, was that something that you really were excited to do, or was it more like an expectation because of your family and your background?
It was definitely both.
It's required of faithful Mormon men to serve a mission. But that said, it was obviously also my choice. I could have chosen not to do that. I definitely underestimated how difficult it would be to, you know, wake up in the morning and it's negative 40 outside and you know, go out the door at 11 and you're back at 9. I know. So people talk about how being a founder is, you know, hard work and it's difficult, but frankly, it's nothing.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, minus 40, like, no thanks. And you're right. There are lots of jobs that require like routine and sacrifice, you know, to levels beyond what founders do that are probably good training for being a founder as well. You mentioned earlier you had spent some time in China. What was that like?
Yeah. So after I got back from Ukraine, I, you know, found life to be very boring in the United States, especially, you know, I moved back to Provo, Utah, where life is already kind of different in the boring sense, I would say. And I just kind of craved that steep learning curve and the adventure and being extremely uncomfortable. You underestimate how difficult just day-to-day life can be when you're trying to learn a second language. So, you know, trying to figure out where the right bus stop is to get to the grocery station and trying to get your radiator fixed. Yeah, who do you call? Who's the radiator repair person in Ukraine? And when you talk to them, how do you say radiator? And how do you explain in Russian that radiator's broken? So I kind of missed that. And China was just me refusing to grow up a little bit and trying to relive that and wanting to experience a totally different culture that I'd never experienced and live a life that I'd never lived and see what that was like.
That's so cool. Did you know exactly where you wanted to go in China? And did you have an ambition to like learn Mandarin or Cantonese or like go to Hong Kong? I mean, yeah, where was the place that you decided to go and how did you decide?
Yeah, it's funny. I was talking with a roommate at the time who is now quite ironically a Lambda School student. We're buddies in Ukraine and then we went to college together and then we both kind of decided that wasn't the right path. And now I started Lambda School and he's a student. So it's pretty fun. But I was kind of sitting there looking at like really Google image searches for all the different cities in China. And I decided that Shanghai looked the most high tech, which I've always been into tech. And he came in and he basically said, you're going to do this, aren't you? Like I've always talked about like, you know, hitchhiking or just kind of going on another adventure after Ukraine. I was like, yeah, I think so. And he's like, no, you're going to do it. And you're going to buy a one-way ticket tonight. And then you're going to figure out the rest later. And so by the time he left the room, I had bought a one-way ticket to Shanghai. And I mean, I had no visa. I had very little money. I was just kind of figuring it out as I went, which is a lot like being a founder. But yeah, that's kind of how it happened.
That's amazing. So coming back to Lambda School a bit, let's break it down. A lot of people, I'm sure like many of our listeners as well, are familiar with the concept, but let's rewind a bit to when you first decided this was something that you wanted to start working on. Talk us through those kind of like initial first steps of finding your co-founders and then I guess making that decision to, you know, raise funding and, you know, get prepared to go to market. What did that look like?
Yeah. So, you know, I was working at LendUp and because of past experience with VCs, I had determined to never raise VC again, which is I've raised $48 million in the last 2 years. So clearly didn't hold to that. But yeah, I wanted to solve a meaningful problem, wanted to solve it in a way where there is kind of impact both financially and to people's lives, and wanted to be able to bootstrap it. So we really started out saying, you know, what can we do? How can we build a school that's better with no money? And really, we launched a free online month-long class, and we taught a bunch of people in that. And then at the end, we said, hey, you should pay us $10,000, and we'll keep training you. And a few people said yes, and that was it. Then we kept talking with all of those people who had signed up and saying, why won't you sign up? And basically, everybody said, well, either I don't have the money, or I don't trust you to get me a job, which is kind of the implicit promise of a school. So we just kind of said, man, if we could actually promise that and actually put our money where our mouth is, that would be amazing. And slowly figured out how to do that.
That's incredible. Was it easy to build that initial team? Like, was it easy to find the people that you wanted to work with, the people who could kind of, you know, complement your skill set and turn the vision into reality?
I mean, it was hard. In the early days, every small win took a whole lot of effort and energy. And, you know, until we really got to true product market fit, it was an uphill battle. That said, you know, I had had experience in the past where we kind of went out to raise money probably too early, and we could raise money, but we never really found that product market fit. So I wanted to make sure that we could, you know, on our own, get to that point without, you know, before I thought about investors. And I pretty actively and intentionally didn't think about investors, and frankly, still don't. And I think that's pretty important to the success of a company long term.
Thanks so much for being so candid about that. I think I'd love to dive a bit deeper into that idea of, you know, lessons that you learned prior to Lambda. You mentioned, you know, the risks that all founders face around raising too soon or never finding product market fit. Product market fit in particular is something that we discuss a lot in the Product Hunt community. A lot of makers are using the community to kind of like help test their assumptions and find out whether there is an audience for what they're building. What did you do better the second time to get to an understanding of whether or not there was a product market fit quicker? I feel like for lots of makers, it's so difficult to know how many more iterations they should try before they really give up, or, you know, what those real indicators are for, you know, that kind of green light to keep going.
Yeah. So I think, you know, first and foremost is I chose a better problem. So I like to think of things in terms of, you know, the problem you want to solve is a problem that's been around for a very long time. It's something that's fundamental to humans. It's not a side problem or a little need. But then solving it in such a way where there's not as much ego involved. Like, I still wonder if I could have made the first company work if instead of me saying this is what it will be, trying to figure out what the right, you know, you still want to have a clear vision, but the path that you take to get there should be very, very flexible. And the path we're taking now doesn't look anything like I would have suspected it would a few years ago. It was just, here's a fundamental human need. Let's figure out what we can do to help people solve that.
This is why I love you on Twitter so much. But I just feel like everything you say is really like relatable and like resonates with me a lot. Solving a real problem. I feel like, and this is purely a personal view, of course, there are a lot of makers who are solving problems that maybe the mass market wouldn't identify as niche, but I see as niche. Like, I don't see their greater application for wider society. I don't see how they're going to solve the people's problems, particularly people who maybe are the most vulnerable in society or who need that most. And I would love for us as an industry within tech to hold ourselves and entrepreneurs more accountable to that idea of, you know, who are we really helping when we solve this problem? We had on a previous episode of Product Hunt Radio, Anne Mura Ko, who's a founding partner at Floodgate. And she said that one of their, you know, guiding principles is, you know, who prospers from this work, and how do we maximize prosperity for all? I wonder what your views are on that.
Yeah, I'm of two minds about that, because I think it's not always obvious when you start out that you're solving a huge problem. I think that's the best way to get to a big company. A lot of times little toys turn into meaningful things. I mean, there's so many just big problems left to solve. I think every founder would be better served to take a step back and say, like, what is the like fundamental thing I'm trying to solve? Not, you know, what does this widget do? How can I sell it better? But like, you know, if I take another step back, what is the actual need? And I think founders solve better problems that way. So, you know, you look at, for example, Stripe, and on the one hand, you could say, you know, the purpose of Stripe is to enable people to get paid faster, to move money around, basically. But you talk to Patrick and John, and they're more focused on how can we grow the GDP of the internet? You know, transactions are a means to the end. How can we make it easier to run companies? How can we make it easier to have businesses that are later stage? They're solving some of those more fundamental aspects of that. But I think being really, really clear on what the problem you're actually solving is, and often you have to start with something that's only a small fraction of that, but figure out what that actually is.
Yeah, that's quite nice to kind of see it from like the two different angles of like, yes, on the macro, I guess you could be changing the world significantly, but maybe it starts out with that kind of like micro, this is like the first iteration of it. That's pretty refreshing too. So staying on the kind of like founder gear for a moment, I'd love to hear a bit more about your leadership style. A lot of the people in our community, like I said, are makers, are founders, but a lot of them are also leading teams in organizations of all sizes, whether it's remote, whether it's a small startup, whether it's, you know, a more mature tech company. So how would you describe your leadership style?
Yeah, that's a really good question. When you start a company that grows as quickly as Lambda School, what your role in the company is changes very quickly. So in the beginning, I led just by doing. I was definitely in the trenches. I was trying to work faster, ship stuff faster. And with a, you know, 0 to 10 person team, that's the solution. Now that we've, you know, got 50 plus people full time, another 100 or so part time, and are growing very quickly, my leadership is more about setting a vision and making sure that everybody in the company understands what we're working towards and why we're working toward it and what the values, how we do that. And frankly, most of what I do right now is just getting the right people involved, getting people who can solve all the problems that used to keep me up at night. It's actually pretty great. If you can get to that point, I highly recommend it as a founder. Now it's more about convincing the right people that Lambda School is real and that we are what we claim to be and that the future is as bright as we think it might be. When you get people all working toward the same vision, I think that's 90% of the battle, honestly.
The no-code space has matured quite a ton since I was a kid. I actually built my first website using Dreamweaver. Nowadays, you can build advanced web apps without writing code using Bubble. Bubble launched on Product Hunt back in 2015. Now more than 250,000 makers and companies have used Bubble to build marketplaces, social networks, CRMs, and more inside their browser. Check it out at bubble.is/producthunt to get started for free.
That's awesome. Are there things that you invest in to, like, you know, maximize on those priorities? You're setting a vision. You have to be an excellent communicator when you're doing that. You have to be open. You have to be transparent. You know, finding awesome talent, that's a challenge that all leaders have. And like you said, you know, building that trust in the brand, just on a personal level, are there things that you invest in to, like, help you fulfill on all of those things?
I have an executive coach. That's probably the most obvious and direct investment that I make. You know, my investment coach now is kind of a former banker, not a very startup-y coach, you would say. So he's very much about the practicalities of running a predictable, long-standing, long-lasting business, which is different than what a lot of, you know, startup-y people have in a coach. And then, you know, we spend a lot of time making sure that we're documenting and that we have everybody understanding the vision, mission, and strategies of the company. So, and the values of the company. So we, you know, have those documented. We talk about them frequently. when you see a staff member do something that applies to the values, you call out how and why that is. And we do an annual get together with the whole company because we are largely remote. And that's, you know, kind of our time to get together and make sure that we're all rowing in the same direction.
That's awesome. So a lot of people in the Product Hunt community are remote workers. I'm sure you know we're a fully distributed team, as is most of AngelList family as well. Why did you make the decision for your company to support remote work?
You know, it started out as, honestly, we wanted to hire a person who's in Utah. We wanted to hire a person who's in California. We wanted to hire another person who's in Washington, D.C. And it was like, well, we can't get this level of talent in San Francisco, so we'll do what we have to do. Also, you know, it's kind of baked into our culture where all of the students are remote and distributed, so we have to figure that out one way or another. It does get more difficult as time scales. So now we're to the point where, you know, we've got a couple of offices and we're hiring a lot of people that are nearby those offices. But I think, I mean, remote work is clearly a trend that is not going away, and it's just a much better quality of life for people. I think the company figuring out how to make that work is the key. That's not as trivial as people would assume, especially when we grow our employee count by 10% a week some days, and that's just intense. Yeah, it's a challenge, and it's a great thing, and it's all trade-offs.
What about how the core team organize themselves? So do you feel that there's maybe like a difference or a distinction between, let's say, like FaceTime with like maybe individual contributors or kind of like everyone else, and then FaceTime with the, you know, top of the pyramid, like group of people that are kind of driving the strategy?
We do a weekly all hands where everybody gets to see everybody. And that's a pretty crazy thing to do when, you know, you've got that many people. Every team kind of has a couple minutes is all. You know, we don't want to waste everybody's time, so that has to be very direct. But it's been pretty important for keeping everybody in the loop of what everybody else is doing, especially because, you know, our business just changes so fast. And we're doing so many different things all at the same time. It's not like we're, you know, all continually implementing the same product and making small tweaks. It's just a constant chaos. One of our values is organized chaos. So that's kind of what we have to do. And then, yeah, I think, you know, as you scale out, you have to have a leadership team that you can really, really trust. So people have to feel like they can do what they think is right. And there won't be, you know, punishment, and they don't need permission, even if we make mistakes. So just empowering the brilliant people around you is, as you scale, really the only way to do it.
You touched on one of your Lambda School values there, organized chaos. What are your other values? I'd be curious to know and love to hear them more about why you picked them.
Let's see. So our first is student obsessed. So basically we do everything for the students. We think about student outcomes. That is the entirety of what we do and what we think about. Organized chaos, which we've talked about. Learn by doing, which is both what we expect of students. And you'll find that all of our values apply both to the staff and the students. Think big. We think that a lot of people underestimate what they can do, what other people around them can do, etc. We've got high quality everything. We insist on high standards. And then we've got speed matters, which seems contradictory to high quality everything, but we actually don't think it's contradictory. We think that the only way to do one is by doing the other.
I like that idea of speed matters. And I agree with you that there is a kind of like tension between, you know, speed and, you know, consistency and quality and stuff like that. But this is actually something that came up in our last offsite in LA in December. One of the most senior designers in the organization, Kai, brought this up and said that in his view, there are like two reasons why speed matters. Like one, the momentum kind of like challenges us to, you know, keep going and, you know, not slack off on any of the objectives and, you know, just produce something that we can like share and iterate on as quickly as possible. And to some extent, that's quite important, especially in the startup environment, because you need that feedback loop with the people you're serving. And he said the second reason is consumers notice when things aren't being updated and when things aren't changing. And while to some extent people sort of resist change, they also kind of like appreciate constant investment and stuff. And I kind of agree with that. He was like, you can kind of like tell, you know, what are the websites or whatever products you use that just like haven't changed a while and like not in a good way. And then you just feel like if no one's working on them, you're not as excited about them. And I thought that was an interesting way to look at it as well.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I think that jives with my experience as well.
You had mentioned earlier about how it's really important for founders to strike that balance between having a really clear vision, but also being open to that flexible path and, you know, the different ways they'll reach it. I can't remember which partner it was at Andreessen Horowitz who said a similar kind of thing around like firm beliefs loosely held. So I wanted to ask you, with Lambda School in particular, having that decision initially to not take outside investment and then fast forwarding to now where you've raised tens of millions of dollars, what caused that change in decision?
So a couple things. The first was, I mean, Lambda School could be a successfully bootstrapped company today. It would just not have the impact, whether you're talking financial or to the world at large, that we are able to have as a result of raising money. So, you know, we have over 1,000 students enrolled right now, and that number is growing quickly. If we were still bootstrapped, we'd probably have 40 or 50 enrolled. But honestly, when we were going through YC, I was talking about whether we even want to raise at Demo Day, which is like the best time in the world to raise, the easiest, cheapest money you'll ever have. Well, actually, that's not true, but there's a high likelihood that that's the case. And basically, we sat down and we built a financial model. So we kind of built out two scenarios. Here's what happens if we don't raise. Here's what happens if we do raise. And basically found that the dilution that we would suffer in raising the seed round would enable us to grow well more than enough to offset that dilution, which I think like that's what VC is predicated on. Everybody assumes that that is the case, but it was actually the case for us. So when basically we did the math and it made sense.
That's awesome. You were thinking about the most sensible way for you to kind of like achieve the scale and the growth that you wanted to do.
Yep, that's exactly right. Part of it is that changed. So, you know, we started Lambda School to be a chill mom and pop business that we could just sit back and collect a paycheck from. That slowly we realized that the problem that we're solving is really big and the people that we're solving it for really need it. And it almost felt a little bit selfish to not expand, to not grow.
Yeah, that's amazing. So let's switch gears and talk a bit about education and, you know, what education looks like in the US, especially, you know, formal education, higher education. So in the UK, for example, it was actually quite a common model for people to kind of take out a loan, usually from the government or a government affiliated body, to fund their university education. And then for the first few years of their employment, have this deducted through Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs or the student loan body. But basically, you don't even know it's really happening to you because it's kind of deducted from your gross salary before you see the money in your bank account. But that's obviously not a model that exists in the US or, you know, necessarily like in other countries. What are to you, the most maybe like frustrating or challenging parts about, you know, higher education that you would like to change or see change?
Yes, I think there are a few things. The first is that we have built everything into the university. No matter what you want to do, no matter what your goals are, the answer and the solution is always a four-year university. And I don't think that makes sense. We have students who already have a college degree, and are just looking to, you know, retrain and reskill into another field. Why should they have to go back for another 4 years of school or, you know, 2 years of school to make that happen? Why is there not a more efficient path? So you've got a university, which is a bundle of all these different things. And if you want just one of those things, you still have to pay for the whole bundle. And given how outrageously expensive it's become, that is less attractive over time. The other thing that has always bothered me, and this is a lot of why I dropped out of college, is just that I felt like my university experience was so detached from what was actually happening in the world. Most of my professors had never worked outside of a university in their lives. They weren't asking, they didn't know what we needed to know to be trained for a job, and they didn't care, and they didn't consider that their role, frankly. But I was there to have a career. That was the main purpose. And so the other stuff was great. You know, I loved hanging out with friends and going to football games and whatever else, but there wasn't enough focus on what I felt like the primary need was. And it's a lot of money and time to spend when your interests are misaligned with the people who are providing the service that you're paying for. So that was my main frustration with the educational system.
I feel that you're absolutely not the only person that had that experience of university. I meet a lot of young people in the tech world or pursuing their own startups who, like you, dropped out of university. They just did the cost-benefit analysis and based it on their, you know, personal objectives and were like, this just doesn't make sense to me. I'm trying to start a career. I'm trying to make money. I'm trying to, create some kind of like tangible results from stuff. And I've written about this a lot, like in my book and in blog posts, and I had a similar sort of feeling. I felt that I spent so much of like high school desperate to like get into a good university to study, you know, economics. And then once I actually started learning it, I kind of felt that to the point that you made, there were few people at the front of that lecture hall who, you know, so many academics have just been in academia their whole life. And then graduating into the recession, I was like, well, they definitely didn't prepare us for that. So yeah, I think the point that you're making resonates a lot and will probably resonate with a lot of people. In your view, what are some of the biggest obstacles to change? I feel that there are so many people that see this and like share that frustration around university not having adapted to the types of careers young people want to make now and adults want to make now. But yeah, what do you see as the obstacles to change?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of just fundamentally built into society around, you know, a university, for example, everything from you can deduct college tuition in some cases from your taxes using various, you know, strategies, but you can't deduct an income share agreement. There are some companies that are real, you know, there are fewer and fewer that require a college degree in a specific field. I mean, there's kind of just a societal shift that needs to happen for Lambda to really be as great as we think it will. But I think it's happening kind of automatically, and we don't have to be the only thing causing that change. It's just a societal shift away from, whoa, this has gotten really expensive and we've put a whole lot of stock into a university that maybe isn't entirely warranted, and so we should take a step back and reevaluate what the proper path is for everybody.
Amazing. I really like the way you touched on, I mean, you didn't call it status, but I do sort of see that as like status. This idea that by asking someone where they went to university or what they studied, you can suddenly make some kind of conclusions about whatever, their experiences, their background, their competencies, for example. How have you and the Lambda School team been able to like challenge employers' views around ideal candidates? Because I feel that historically, a lot of the reasons why we put so much investment into universities is because we felt that without that label, without that brand, we wouldn't necessarily get our foot in the door at these institutions that we admire and want to work at. And yet, you know, you're doing that. You know, you've had hundreds of graduates who've landed jobs at really impressive companies. How have you been able to change their views on like, you know, what makes an ideal candidate?
Usually it's just saying, interview them. Had a lot of companies that have said, yeah, you know, we're looking for a student with a computer science degree that has written a lot of Java. And we say, okay, well, you know, just interview this one and see what you think. And then they'll interview that student, they'll hire them, and then they'll come back and say, you know, can you give us 10 more? Can you give us 100 more? I think the biggest we've ever seen is, you know, what would it take to train 1,000 people just like this next year? You're like, oh my gosh. So it really is just, I guess we're on Product Hunt, so we can consider our students as a product to some degree. And if the product is good enough, then that's what really matters at the end of the day.
That's awesome. Did you ever have resistance initially to like convincing employers to interview people that maybe don't, you know, tick all the boxes of their usual requirements or criteria?
Yes. So, I mean, that's a constant ongoing battle. We have a full team that's their full-time job. They convince people to come in and interview students. We've had students placed at, you know, Google and Amazon and Uber, and I think we got Cisco today that got some IBM that are pretty close. So it's just a matter of time before everybody kind of comes around to it.
Amazing. So I appreciate all the insights into leadership and running startups. Now, being the Product Hunt podcast, we of course can't let you leave without telling us about some of the products that you love. So what's on your home screen? What are the tools that you and the team love to use? And yeah, like what are some of the products maybe at home that you enjoy using with your family?
Oh, yeah, let's see. Slack, big fan and now customer of Slack. We pay them a whole lot of money. Notion is another favorite. I like Pocket. I use Pocket a lot. And then I'm a huge fan of Superhuman, the email client.
What is your favorite feature about Superhuman? Someone the other day mentioned that the instant intros was a game changer. Curious to hear what you love about it.
The instant intros is great. So I love that I can just see one screen and hit E or whatever, and it will archive the last email and the next one will pop up. So, you know, as a startup founder, I get a whole lot of email, and just being able to manage that all quickly. I now, you know, I box it out and I do kind of an hour a day, and I can burn through 300 emails in an hour with Superhuman. And I don't think I would be able to do that in any other way. So it's a lifesaver.
Wow. That's crazy. Cool. So what about tech in the home? Are you a smart home kind of family? What's going on there?
We have some Echoes at home. We use smart bulbs and smart lamps in bedrooms because I've got a 3-year-old and a 1-year-old. And the 1-year-old, if he's sleeping, you don't want to wake him up, but you want to turn the light on and off. You don't want to get out of bed. That's key. Oh, I should have mentioned AirPods. I think I've bought like 5 pairs, but 2 of which I probably lost somewhere, but I'm religious AirPods user, as is my wife. I converted her finally. Yeah. And then, I mean, most of the time we're just using Echoes to play music or turn lights on and off, or in the kitchen, use it to get recipes or tell us what the score of a game is or stuff like that. But yeah, definitely. I don't know if that counts as smart home. That's just one thing, but that's all we've got.
It's still cool though. Are you based in the Valley now, or are you in Utah?
So I live in the East Bay, and then we have an office in Utah as well, but an office in San Francisco, office in Utah, and I live in the Bay Area.
Nice. Awesome. Cool. Well, I appreciate you taking time out of your busy day to share your story and all your tips with our community. This is kind of the part of the show where you have the floor. You can tell people where to find you, where to find out more about your work and the ways that they can support you.
Yeah, you can go to lambdaschool.com and apply. Follow me on Twitter. I'm Austin Allred. And fair warning, I will be tweeting mostly about Lambda School. So one way or the other, you're still getting Lambda School.
Austin, thanks so much for being on Product Hunt Radio today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks for tuning in. We'll be back next week. But in the meantime, share the podcast with your friends on Twitter and tag a guest you'd like to hear in a future episode. See you soon.